Next step, 691, the last prime to 700. September 2nd, 2021.
Hi there, this is Susie from In His Shoes Ministries. Thanks for tuning into The Next Step with Father Vazquez. We are the voice of Armodoxy, a weekly podcast started in 2008 that looks at life through the lens of Armenian Orthodoxy. We reach out to those who are searching for practical and deeper applications of faith, the disenfranchised members of the church community, and the neophyte, those who are discovering truths in ancient Orthodoxy. If you're joining us for the first time, we're so glad you're here. And if you're a regular listener, welcome back. Now, let's get ready to take the next step.
Welcome to this edition of The Next Step. We're going to start off today with a prayer. I invite you to join in this meditation by St. Gregory of Narek.
Եվ քանզի այս նոր փրկության շնորհներին գոհաբանությամբ հետևելով եւ տեսնելով նրանց շատությունն ամբավ լրացի իսկույն ու պապանձվեցի ուստի եւ ահա հիշելով դարձյալ լույսի տանսպար բարիքներն ամեն որոնք քո կողմից սպարգեված են ինձ համար թշվառիս քո աղերսով քեզ պիտի պաղատեմ Իմ այս մատյանի խոսքերին դարձյալ հարմարացնելով թախծությամբ լեցուն հեծեծակին բազմաթիվ տողեր։ Սակայն ի հեճույս տվողիդ պիտի առնեմ ու խառնեմ ցավերի հետ դեղ, վհատության հետ խրախույս, հուսահատության հետ հիշատակն անվան հաստողիդ, տխրությանս հետ սփոփանքը քո, դառնությանս հետ քաղցությունը կենարարիդ, օրենքի պատճի հետ քո շնորը, անիծապարտության հետ օրհնությունը տազատարար, մարմնի մավան հետ նորոգությունը դկատար, և քեզ վայելեփառք իշխանություն և պատիվ, այժմ և միշտ և հավիտյանս հավիտենից, ամեն։
Let's say it together, amen, amen. Prayer of Saint Gregory of Narek starts us off today. And the voice of he who read it, a voice that has been silenced, Father Malachia Amirian of blessed memory, just passed away 2-3 days ago. And we are still in a state of shock. Those people that knew him, really, I could tell you, one of the bright, bright stars of the Armenian Church. Someone who really got it. Who had it together, somebody who understood people, more importantly, understood the love of Christ toward people, and shared that love, died at the age of 40, another victim of the coronavirus, COVID-19. It's been a very rough, rough week, needless to say, for his family, for his friends, for priests, for bishops, for people who knew him, because you just realize that this horrible disease is sweeping the planet. It's pandemic. Yeah, it's pandemic. And it's extremely difficult. What is that the word? Understandable when you have people who are politicizing a disease and rallying people against cautions, against simple cautions. But that's another story, and it's not what I want to share with you today. It's just difficult. It's difficult because I see so much of it. I've shared with you since the beginning of this year, 2021, the number of funerals I have presided over and the number of funerals that other priests, my colleagues, have presided over is skyrocketed. Skyrocketed. You can't believe how many we do a week. And they take their toll not only on families but on us as the servers. Because you realize that at some point people need to exercise better caution. But what good if the caution is not exercised throughout? And we're seeing that. We're seeing that. And new waves of coronavirus. But as I said, I don't want to get into the politics, sadly, politics of vaccination, of caution. Especially because of who I am. At my age, I remember when we had diseases called polio, whooping cough. We had diseases called smallpox. You don't see them anymore. You don't see them anymore, because why? Vaccines. Yeah, science. Science comes out and says, okay, here's a way of preventing it. Just a few days ago on TV, there was an old show, and I just caught a glimpse of it. And there was a kid. There was a kid on there with his cheeks that were like chipmunks. And I called Susan over. I said, quick, look at this. Do you remember mumps? Hey, people don't know what mumps are now. Why? Because there's vaccines for it. Yeah, we used to get mumps. Our glands around our neck would swell, chipmunks, you know? I don't know what the disease was. We don't need care about it anymore. It's done. But for some reason, people politicized this one. Well, not for some reason. We know the reasons, right? Politics. I want to talk about this man, Father Malchia Amirian. A big, big and tragic loss for the Armenian Church. A young Vartabed, priest of the church, who took his vows toward the church so seriously that he excited love, harmony in the people he met. If you have a chance to, if you have Facebook, I would strongly suggest to go to his page and just see the comments that have been left by young and old, by clergy, by laity. See the videos, see the people, the sharing. Here was a bright, bright star of the Armenian Church. I met Father Amarakia back in 2009. Yeah. And since then, we've been in touch. In fact, just a month ago, he was in the United States. He's the director, or the dean, excuse me, of the Youth Center in Etchmiadzin. And this, you know, the work that he's doing, incredible work. Because of a war-torn country, trying to get young people connected with their faith, to understand the power of faith in moving yourself into identity. Just tremendous, tremendous work. He was the dean of the youth centers in particularly in Etchmiadzin. He was a member of the Brotherhood of Etchmiadzin, but we got to meet him in 2009. He had just been ordained a priest a couple of years earlier, and Arsetbalzan, our primate, Archbishop Hovnan, had nominated me to go to Etchmiadzin to participate in the Revontians meetings. This is the meeting of all the priests, 2009, and I said this would be a great opportunity to go with my son Vatajan. And the two of us went together. He accompanied me. And yeah, we were broadcasting back then, and there are archives of the next step from that time, because we broadcast from Armenia. We took the mic with us. We shared the experience from Armenia. It was 2009. It was February, Revontians feast, and Serpazan had made arrangements for Father Malchia to take care of us, quote unquote. In other words, to show us around, to give us a bit of the tour that most people don't get, you know, the background stuff. And I've got to tell you, for me, that entire trip was a walk down memory lane. I hadn't been back to the monastery since my seminarian days back in 77 and 78. So it was a good 30-plus years since I had been to Armenia, since I had lived there, since I had grown there, since I had walked through the seminary and inside the walls of the seminary, and now to go back with my son and get this opportunity of a lifetime for a couple weeks to have Father Mahakia show us around. And just such a gracious, gracious host. And it was cool. I mean, he had this cool little phone. I'll never forget it. Tiny, tiny. He reminded me a lot of me because he was 27 years old when he was ordained. I was 26. And just the sparkle, the way he approached the church, just we connected at a very grassroots level. And we were together for a good 2 weeks. He would take us around and show us. But one of the most memorable times that we had with him was at the River Arax. This Arax is the river that divides Armenia and Turkey, present-day Turkey. And he took us down to a zone which nobody else, you can't go there unless you knew the right people. Why? Because, well, it's the border. And you had Armenian troops on one side and you had Turkish troops on the other side of this river. So we're right on the river bank. I mean, there's water coming down. And Father Mahakia had a good friend who was inside of the an army buddy. And so he opened up the gates for us, and we were able to go down right to the riverbed. And we're watching the Arax River go by, and Father Mahakia turns to me and he says, "You see, right across the way, I don't know, I want to say it was something like maybe about 50 feet, 100 feet across the river." He says, "That's Turkey. We're in Armenia and that's Turkey." And I don't know what, I was overtaken by so much emotion because you realize that that's your land and it's this beautiful, fertile land that they've taken from you. It's like your history is there. Your history is in the soil. It's in there's blood in that soil. And they're calling it Turkey? What? Anyway, I was taken by so much emotion that I picked up a rock. Just out of frustration, I threw it. I threw it. Yeah, like a kid, I guess. You know the frustration where it overcomes you? You don't know what you're doing, but you just do it. And I'm just so frustrated that you're looking at Turkey over there and you're standing in Armenia. And I took this stone and I just like threw it across the river. And Father Mahakia turned to me and he says, dead-eyed, he said, "Don't throw anything over there." He says, "We have given them so much land. Don't give him not even one more stone." What a profound statement, huh? And it was quick. It was quick. It was quick. And it just gives you a little idea of what he was about. And since the time we met, I was very fortunate because whenever he'd come to the United States, he'd always come down and celebrate the Divine Liturgy at our church in Glendale at the Youth Ministry Center. Obviously, it spoke to his heart. And, you know, that was one of the interesting things. If you look on the net and you see some of the videos of him, as always surrounded by youth, always coming. There was a beautiful little a little memorial that they did from Shoragat TV just a couple days ago. And in it, there was somebody referring to that wherever he would go, there would always be young kids that would be following, just touching his verar, his robes and his hat. And just, it was just very beautiful. I don't know. It's hard to describe and explain. It's even harder when you realize that this is really one of those tragic losses where, you know, somebody dying at age 40, he had done so much with the short life that he had. How much more he could have done? How much more he could have done? There's that question, you know. And I've got to be honest with you, though, during the last several weeks, this has been coming up over and over. I've been just so amazed at the lives. I think it was last week that we were talking about the shortness of the lives of some of these fantastic musicians. Yes, in fact, I remember I shared with you the idea of Club 27. And over the course of the last several weeks, I've been looking at many of the musicians, their lives, particularly John Coltrane's going to be coming out with. I think that's what really kind of got me looking in this direction. There's a new collection of music that has just been found, and it's going to debut in October, John Coltrane. And you start looking at the creativity, and you think about somebody like a John Lennon, who was shot down at age 40, same age, at age 40, and what he had done and accomplished in those years, and what new music could have been written. I started listening to music. I've been following so many music channels and listening to expressions, been going back and hearing so many interviews with celebrities talking about their lives and everything. And you realize that, you know, there are few people that have chances to make so much difference in the world. Few people that have that open microphone, so to speak, and in which they can influence and change so many people. Father Mahakya was one of those people. Father Mahakya his microphone was himself. He had an enduring personality. He was a man of the people. He would get inside of crowds and he'd work them. He was part of the youth, the Pan-ACYO, the Pan-America. What's it called? Pan International. Anyway, they had some cute name for it, where the youth from all throughout the world got together. And this began at the 1700th anniversary of Christianity. That was in the year 2001. And it's continued. It's had many revisions. I think the last time they gathered was pre-pandemic 2018. So he's always had his hand in there. And then all of a sudden you hear this tragic, tragic news. And it was interesting. He had celebrated the Divine Liturgy here in the Western Diocese. And if I'm not mistaken, that must have been his last Divine Liturgy that he celebrated here. And he got on a plane and went back to Armenia. No sooner had he gotten there, he wrote, he tweeted that, you know, Father Mahakya, he's talking in the third person, now has COVID. And just a week had passed, and we heard from him that, you know, I'm sorry I can't get back to all the people who wish me well. Just bear with me. I'll be okay. And I'll get back to everybody. And the next thing we heard was that he had passed. And it was shocking. I'm still in shock. I'm still in shock. Perhaps you can tell, by the way. Maybe am I rambling, or am I sharing enough information to give you an idea of what a tragic loss this is? Father Mahakya ends his life, a beautiful life, and I will put links on our show notes to share with you that life, what he meant, different links. Please explore them. And why don't we go to the song of the week, okay? Let's do that. And I think, you know, considering everything I've told you, what you need to know is Father Mahakya was just such a beautiful man, inside and outside, and this golden voice. It wasn't like an operatic voice. It was a voice of the people. And I'd like to share that with you right now. He would sing wherever he was. I had the good fortune. He celebrated the Divine Liturgy at my church on my birthday. It happened to be. And he didn't know it was my birthday. And, you know, not too many people know when my birthday is. But my parish had made a cake and some coffee after church service. And he sang a happy birthday to me. He put me in his arms and he sang a happy birthday to me. That's the kind of person that he was. But I found this beautiful song, this people song, and he sings it with the young people. And I want to believe, you know, one thing that he gave me, Father Mahakya gave me, was hope. I have been through a lot in my 40 years as a priest, as a deacon, serving the church, and there are a few people that really inspire hope in me, that give me that hope, because there is a lot of tragedy. There is a lot of things to look down on, but he would give you hope. You'd say that if there's a guy like this that's in the church, you've got to have hope. You've got to have hope that things will be okay. And that's why I'm telling you it's such a great loss, because that voice was silenced. But for right now, I want to share with you his voice with young people, because I want to believe that that hope can stay alive and we can keep it alive. And you're going to see exactly what I mean. This is Father Malchia at a gathering with the young people in Armenia, sharing a couple Armenian folk songs, which I know you will recognize. Enjoy.
Oh.
couple of Armenian folk songs, actually Armenian people songs. Yeah, folk songs. Getting the people up is Father Mahakya Amirian, a voice that will be heard no more. Fortunately, these recordings exist thanks to social media. He was very active on social media, and I've got to tell you, since Monday, social media is a buzz. It's like you can't turn without seeing something, somebody writing. So many people were affected by this man, and sadly, this voice is done. But his memory, the hope that he brings to all of us, that's something that we can keep going. And I hope you will, from this short little introduction that I gave you this morning. I am asking you to find out more, keep him alive by doing the things that are important, of smiling when you preach the gospel, of enjoying and celebrating the gospel. Like I said, he resonated with me. He touched me in many, many ways. And I feel like I'm a better person for knowing him. And I think there's a lot of people who feel that way too. Father Mahakya Amirian, 40 years old, 1980, passed away this month, 2021. He would have been 41 years old on September 13th. Second portion of today's next step is going to be a little bit more sociological, I think, as opposed to, say, theological or religious or spiritual or whatever category you put the next step in. Sociological in the sense it kind of like looks at the Armenian church in particular, but I hope that you can apply it to a broader cross-section of Christendom. There's some phenomenal things that happen within the Armenian church, and this was a conversation that we had today. Today, the Bishop Daniel Findikian, the primate of the Eastern Diocese, was the guest of the primate of the Western Diocese, and we were invited to a very special luncheon with clergy and a few guests, and we were able to be with the bishops. And then in a more informal setting, we had an opportunity to just talk. And it was maybe about 6-7 of us. And I wanted to share with you a small little conversation that took place, because it has to do with identity more than anything else. And hopefully we'll understand it as a Christian identity. But the Armenian church, many times I've shared with you, is there's a misunderstanding about the history and the authority of the Armenian church. We refer to the Armenian church as apostolic, and because of that, we go back to the times of the apostles, claiming that Saint Thaddeus, one of the 12, was the one who first visited Armenia and brought Christianity, the light of Christ, to Armenia. And we can trace our origins, we can trace our church to the time of the apostles. But as I've shared with you on many occasions, that this sometimes fools us into believing that the church is 2,000 years old. And yes, it is. You know, on paper, it sounds right. But in reality, our church is really, the Armenian church is really about 110 years old. In that when the Armenians went through genocide in 1915 at the hands of the Ottoman Turks, the Turks had a strategy. They said, let's deal with the Armenians once and for all. Now, when you want to kill somebody, what do you go for? You go for the jugular vein. What is the jugular vein? This is the one that's keeping the life, blood, going to all the organs and making sure that you are alive. And the jugular vein of the Armenian people is the Armenian church. They went for the Armenian church. In fact, April 24th, which is always remembered as Armenian Genocide Day, the significance of that day was that that was the day of the roundup, something I think like 300 intellectuals. And in that group was the church, the leadership of the church. And, you know, the whole idea was that, you know, if you want to kill the entity, well, kill the source, kill the blood, the one that provides the blood, get rid of the jugular vein, go for the jugular vein. And that was the plan, kill the Armenian church and the people will die. And the Armenian church suffered immensely during the genocide. There are records of, you know, a couple thousand clergymen. There's records, and Teotic is one of the most famous of these records, but there are multiple different records, accountings of how the clergy perished. One is referred to as the Golgotha. This is Golgotha, of course, is where Jesus was crucified. And so the Golgotha of the Armenian people, the Golgotha of the Armenian nation, of the Armenian clergy, of the Armenian church. It's the crucifixion. It's the killing. It's the killing of the nation. And torturing, just as Jesus was tortured. Well, think about it now. You go for the jugular vein, you kill off this church, and really, by the grace of God and by a few clergymen, thanks to Holy Etchmiadzin, by the way. Holy Etchmiadzin. Yeah, there's no other, there was no other center. Holy Etchmiadzin. Thanks to Holy Etchmiadzin. 1918, the ringing the bells of Etchmiadzin, calling the people to Sardarabad. It was the final opportunity. It was the final stopping of the Turks. And just very grim stories. There's a lot written about this. I've shared with you many, many times. But basically, by 1923, when the genocide was officially over after the 7 years, the Armenian church was a mess. It was a wreck. And so when we talk about the Armenian church being 2,000 years old, really, the Armenian church started about 100 years ago. It started with the ruins of post-genocide society. And you've got a handful of clergy. And they set out to resurrect the Armenian church. And so many times when people become critical of why the Armenian church isn't doing that, isn't doing this, you got to remember that, you know, it was like completely, completely devastated. And so what we have, I mean, you know, those priests that sometimes get criticized, oh, all you care about is building a building and building. That's easy to say today. But when you have nothing and everything was not only killed off, leveled off, right? Leveled. I mean, you're starting from scratch. And what gets people to say we're going to build again? We're going to make again, you know? What makes people do that? It's that inner drive. It's that inner feeling. It's that inner faith of rebuilding, of resurrecting. And so it is miraculous. Really, the Armenian church being alive today is a miracle in itself. 100 years and here it is. Okay, yeah, it has a lot of shortcomings, but you've got to give a break. You've got to give a break. And that's where I'm going with this. We're sitting today and we were talking about a lot of things that are taking place in the Armenian church. Namely that, like all and major traditional churches, it is suffering because of numbers. But on the other hand, there are pockets, and I've shared with you many times, there are places where it is flourishing beyond what you can believe, what you can imagine. And it's interesting because here's the sociological part. Because you have areas where population has been there since the time of the genocide. So just real quickly, 1915, after the genocide, the diaspora was created, and you have Armenians going throughout the world. And one of the first things that they do wherever they go is they build their church, and it becomes the hub, the center of all community activities, with having Jesus Christ at the center of all of that activity is something that sometimes gets forgotten, but it's there. It's part of the building, right? Jesus Christ in the center. Okay, so you've got this situation where the last 100 years put together and trying to build it up together. But slowly, the numbers start diminishing. Whereas for the first generation of survivors of the genocide, church becomes a center. It's the place where you come and you meet, and it's the ghetto, right? It's the place where people of the same culture are there. But as the generations go on, and second and third generations, and your population shifts, it starts going different directions, urbanization and so on and so on, millions of different factors playing into it. We found ourselves here, and I was young deacon at the time, but back in the 70s, you had a big problem. The numbers were down. The numbers were incredibly down. That's only 50, 60 years after the genocide. In fact, so down that it was a crisis situation. I remember, listen to this, okay? I remember early 70s as a college boy, they had me sit on a panel with, I actually remember the people that were on the panel, organized by the diocese to talk about, you know, the crisis in the Armenian church. And I was representing the youth. I mean, these discussions are nothing new. It was going back on over there, you know, like 50, 60 years ago. So anyway, we're 1970s, what happens in Beirut, there's civil war, and all of a sudden you've got immigrants coming, and you're repopulating, and a new burst of energy. What happens late 70s? Ayatollah Khomeini. Remember the hostage takeover, the American embassy in Tehran. And so what happens? You have this immigration again. You have Iranians coming to America, and with them are the Armenians from Iran coming into America, and a new generation, a new population of people. Add to that the massive one in the early 90s, 1991, the fall of communism, and all of a sudden the doors to Armenia are open, and you have this mass exodus, and they come here. And by the way, these three mass migrations from Beirut, the Middle East, Iran, and Armenia, most of them are coming into Southern California. Now, I left off the refugees. Now, there was a big slew of refugees from Baku coming, and I didn't include them because these were refugees, and as refugee status, they were placed in different, the government placed them in different cities. And I was the priest actually in San Jose when this was happening. We had many coming into San Francisco and San Jose, so I'm very familiar with that group of that migration as well. But I'm not including it because we've got these three groups that repopulated the Armenian church here in the Western Diocese, particularly in the Los Angeles area, which became the hub, moving south from Fresno. Fresno used to be the center for this diocese, and now it was in Southern California, and you've got, you know, like 200,000-300,000 Armenians. And with it, you have all the social problems that come with any group of people that has a mass number of people coming in there. Well, what happens is the churches start filling, and you've got basically a repeat of what happened after the genocide. So if you could picture 1920s, 1930s, the new generation of people looking for companionship, looking for people, ghetto, not in any derogatory way, but a ghetto in other words, that there's this bigger population, but we will keep ourselves together by finding one another, and at least once a week we know that we can get together at the church, and this is where the community hub existed. So what was happening in 1920s, 1930s was now repeating in the 70s and 80s and early 90s. New group of people coming in. When we're now like 30 years from those events, the last of that wave, we're 50 years away from the first wave of that second group of people coming in, okay? So what happens now? Well, we are having the same issues. Now, a few months ago, I was speaking with Archbishop Hovnan about some programs that we're going to be doing for American-born Armenians. And it was interesting because he reminded me that American-born Armenians are not just that first generation, that wave that came after the genocide, but American-born Armenians are now this giant new population. Those people who came in the 70s, 80s, and 90s, their children have now been born in America. They are the new American, quote-unquote, American-born Armenians. And I'm saying this because that title, American-born, is a loaded gun. You know, it comes with, well, these are people that care more about the religion than they care about the nationality, and so on and so on. And some of the old hardliners would argue against this. Well, guess what? Now they're arguing against people who came right out of the Middle East, have been here now for 30 years, 40 years, and are not speaking the language, are not reading the language, are not writing the language. And a very unique situation is happening. To feel Armenian, you identify with the Armenian Church. To seek religious or spiritual comfort and understanding, you go to non-Armenian churches. Why? Well, it's so basic. The non-Armenian church speaks to you in a language that you can understand. And I'm not just talking about English as opposed to Armenian, because there's a lot of people who understand Armenian, but you'll find them in such places as in the Mormon congregation, as in the Jehovah's Witness congregation, where there is no Armenian being spoken, and yet their primary language is Armenian, but you'll find them there. So that tells you something, right? Pentecostal. They are receiving some spiritual nourishment. And what I described is a phenomenon that's happening here in Southern California and here in the Western Diocese of fast growing. It's a fast growing diocese over the last 40, 50 years. So here's what I asked Bishop Daniel, and it was something I'm going to share with you just to give you something to think about. Really think about this. If you look at the Eastern Diocese, and I know so many of our listeners are from the Eastern Diocese, and I would love to hear from you what you think about this idea. But I asked if the Eastern Diocese has not had this influx of newcomers in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. We can basically say that the Eastern Diocese, by virtue of it being an older diocese, is about 20 to 30 years older than the Western Diocese historically on a timeline, but also sociologically. When you look at it, this is the group of people that came many years ago, and their connection to the Armenian Church is not a connection of nationality, but a connection of spirituality. And it's interesting because, I mean, this is a conversation we're having today. Just a week ago, my dear friend Gore dropped me a text message, and he said, check out this sermon. And it was a priest in Florida, an Armenian priest in Florida, and a beautiful sermon he gave. And at the end of the sermon, I realized that he had given it only in English, a phenomena which I'm not accustomed to, having been here in Southern California and in California all my life, serving in the parishes, but especially in Southern California, where every sermon has to have an Armenian component in it. And it was just interesting. So I asked Bishop Daniel, I said, okay, if we're to assume that the Eastern Diocese is about 25, 30 years ahead of us, in the sense that it was founded 30 years before our diocese, the migration of Armenians came from the Eastern United States to the Western, and that accounts for that 20-year period. And if that's the case, can you imagine yourself being a time traveler and you have now arrived at the Western Diocese? And what advice would you give us as what we are to expect in another 25 to 30 years? Are you with me on that? I mean, it's a really interesting idea, a question, a pondering, because where are we headed with all this? What are the tools that we are giving our children for them to be able to keep and maintain the Armenian church? And you get into this whole idea of, well, what is that faith? And these are things that we've struggled with for years. Back in the 1980s, maybe it was in the early 90s. No, I would say 1980s. There was a group of Americans, not ethnically connected to neither Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, but they found value in the Orthodox communion. And late 70s, I want to say, okay, this is like Peter Gilchrist and all them. And I was serving in San Jose, which was very close to Ben Lomond, where there was a center. And as late as to 2007, I want to say, because we had gone up there for Susie's graduation, and we went to the Ben Lomond Church. And it was interesting because it was on the way down. The population was going down. Whereas in its heyday, when I saw it back in the 1980s, it was bursting at the seams. You had a small little community that had something like 50 pastors. No exaggeration. 50 ordained priests. And these were not ethnically Greek, Russian. They were just Orthodox. And they were picked up by the Antiochians. And so you have an interesting sociological study here, because people are coming there for the faith and not for the nationalism or what the national, the ghetto. They're not coming there for the ghetto. I hope you're with me on this one, because I think this is an important discussion to have. It's an important, if you're charting out a course, you want to know. If imagine somebody coming up to you and telling you, this is what you're in for. This is what you're in store for. We do this all the time, right? As parents, we tell our children, this is what you are in store for. Imagine somebody coming from the future, 20, 30 years from today, and telling you this is what you are in store for. And we have that opportunity right now. We can look at these patterns. And certainly sociologists do this. It's time that we adapt these studies and look at it in terms of the sociological dimension of the church, that these are places where people come to congregate. And what is it that we are to expect? Yes, I told you a few minutes ago. Thank you. Yes, I just told you a few minutes ago that I saw this priest who spoke in Florida, and there was like all English. And I brought this up, and Bishop Daniel said, yes, there are many churches in the diocese where English is spoken. And then offline, he told me that there were many, many, not just a few, many, many people who were converts. A word that I learned today, reverts, people who had were born and baptized in the Armenian Church, left the Armenian Church for a variety of reasons, and then reverted when they realized that the true faith belongs in the Armenian Church. So there's all kinds of studies that can be made, but it's interesting. Are they really that necessary when you have people who are living in the future right now, namely in these older dioceses, who have the same set of conditions that you have, and you do have them? What are we to expect? What are we to expect in the next 20 to 30 years? And believe it or not, this was the discussion that we had back in the 1970s on those panel discussions. But little did we know that Beirut was going to explode, that the Shah of Iran was going to fall, and communism was going to fall. And that's the one thing that you can't count on, is what's going to happen in history. A lot of events. Anyway, we're going to stop right there, and I'm going to come back in just a couple moments and tie it all up. Got a couple announcements for you too, okay? Here's Susie.
Before getting back to the next step with Father Rozgen, I'd like to take this opportunity to remind you that this ministry is supported through the heartfelt donations of listeners like you. Thanks for keeping us in your prayers and partnering with this expanding and dynamic outreach. The next step is entering homes and communities with a solid message proclaiming God's message of love, forgiveness, and compassion. We look forward to your comments and words of encouragement. Please consider partnering in this dynamic ministry by making a contribution. By pressing on the donate button on our website, you can set up automatic donations, either weekly, monthly, or annually. Your donation goes a long way in furthering this ministry. Even more, tell your friends and family by sharing the Next Step link or website with them. We're on iTunes and Blueberry, as well as Facebook and Twitter. We are excited about this ministry and invite you to share in our enthusiasm. This is Susie wishing you all of God's blessings in your life. We now return to the next step with Father Rozgen.
Thank you, Susie, for that announcement. And thank you, all of you, for all of your kind words, thoughts, prayers, and support for this ministry. Listen, you know, there's so much going on in the world, and I wanted to share with you some ideas. Of course, when I got very emotional this week. It was a very, very difficult week with the passing of Father Marakia. In a sense, it's almost like a dream, like he was a dream, especially because he was just in our presence less than a month ago, and because there was so much life in him. And I think it's very important that we talk about that we do have faith, and as creatures of faith, people of faith, you have to rely on that faith. Otherwise, these kind of deaths, they just get you and you realize, wow, is that all there is to life? Of course not. There has to be something more. We're feeling, spiritual, emotional beings, and you know that there has to be something more. And how beautiful it is that we do have faith, that we can count on, we can fall back on that faith. This week, certainly I wanted to talk about what was going on in Afghanistan, the loneliness of the people that they're feeling, abandonment. There's those topics we wanted to talk about. Of course, yesterday's decision in Texas and the Supreme Court of the United States not overturning anything is that in Texas now, basically, abortions are outlawed, contrary to the rule of the land. And it's kind of like an interesting technicality. It basically says that they can take anybody can take abortion, anybody who has helped in abortion, or even if you thinking about helping somebody in abortion, which gets into, you know, thought policing and everything. But basically, this is the new law. And so all of the abortion clinics have closed down in Texas because nobody wants to be sued. Interesting, huh? You want something done, go for the pocketbook. They've put a bounty, so to speak, $10,000. They could be sued for $10,000. So if you are an abortion clinic, even if you're not doing abortions, you've been doing it all along. You've already got people focused in on you. Anybody can just come and sue you to the tune of $10,000. You would have to hire a lawyer to defend yourself. And even if you win at the end of it, you're still going to have to pay that lawyer. If you lose, then of course, there's so much more. You got the $10,000 plus the lawyer's fees. So think about it. Who wants to do it? And so it's interesting. You know, if you want something done, just go for the pocketbook. Go for, you know, all these years people have been debating abortion, no abortion. Forget it. Just pass a law that puts a high price tag on it, and it's already done. Isn't that what's happening here? This is not going to go away. It's going to be a big one, and certainly one that we want to be able to express ourselves and take that Armadox approach to it in the next few weeks, okay? This Sunday, I will be at the Holy Apostles Church in Tujunga, California. What a beautiful church. Been there for a couple weeks now. I'm just enjoying it so much. Just a beautiful place and a spiritually uplifting place. If you happen to be in the area, please stop by and say hello. That wraps it up for today. Please look for us on the web, on the socials. Of course, you could drop me a line at feedback@epostle.net. That's apostle with an E, symbolizing electronic, and expanding, symbolizing the universe. Whoa, just don't get this anywhere else. On behalf of Susie, our producer, and myself, Father Voskin, we look forward to seeing you again next week when we will take the next step.
And now here's the fine print.
The information and comments presented within this podcast and our website do not necessarily represent the views of the Armenian Church hierarchy, but are presented as a challenge to define the dynamics of Armenian Orthodoxy in all aspects of life. Listening to these shows is habit-forming. Addictive behavior associated with the next step is rarely, if ever, remedied. Rather, the next step is known to relieve and cure common cases of narrow-mindedness, prejudice, numbskullness, and glaucoma in patients over the age of 20. Results may vary depending on credit rating. Findings are based on double-blind studies conducted in Istanbul and Jerusalem. Side effects include mind expansion, clarity of focus, higher rates of heart palpitations, sensitivity to the pain of others, and occasional nausea. The management and production crew of epostle.net take full responsibility for changes you will experience. Not valid with any other offer.
Take your breath cut out.
I want to test you if you're seeing the same sky as we are.
Off balloon top visits.